Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a fake video of Nancy Pelosi appearing to be drunk and slurring her words, which has gone viral, along with a doctored tape of her shown on Fox that Trump retweeted. And we'll look into the technology behind these manipulated videos known as deep fake. Jonathan Taplin, founder and director emeritus of the Innovation Lab at the Annenberg School of Communication at the University of Southern California and author of Move Fast and Break Things, How Google, Facebook, and Amazon Cornered Culture and Undermined Democracy, joins us. We'll discuss the extraordinarily arrogant and irresponsible response from Facebook in refusing to pull the doctored Pelosi video off their platform and explore the nature of the technology that enables trolls to literally put words in the mouths of prominent people or anyone else for that matter, which could be used in future political campaigns. Filmmaker Jordan Peele alerted us to the potential of deep fake video to do untold harm with a video he produced using previous file footage of President Obama giving a speech that segued into Obama saying crazy stuff in his own voice and from his own lips, all of which was deep faked. Imagine the malign potential of releasing a video of your opposing candidate on the eve of the election, having him or her giving a speech suddenly saying they are great admirers of Adolf Hitler, for example. But given the emergence of fake news and Russian trolling, it is hard not to expect that this kind of political poison is heading our way. Then, with the growing possibility that a war might erupt in the Gulf between the US and Iran, triggered by proxies and shadow warriors, we'll be joined in the studio by Annie Jacobson, the author of Area 51, An Uncensored History of America's Top Secret Military Base, which was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. We'll discuss her new book just out, Surprise, Kill, Vanish, The Secret History of CIA Paramilitary Armies, Operators, and Assassins. Annie pulls back the curtain on the history of covert warfare and state-sanctioned assassination since World War II to the present, and takes us inside the darkest and most morally ambiguous corner of our government. Then finally, with Nevada being the 15th state to adopt the National Popular Vote Bill, which works around the Electoral College by having states grant its electoral votes to whoever wins the popular vote nationwide, we will speak with Sanford Levinson, the Centennial Chair in Law at the University of Texas Law School, the author of Fault Lines in the Constitution, The Framers, Their Fights, and the Flaws That Affect Us Today. He joins us to discuss how to fix our broken democracy, which is on a path to elect future presidents with far fewer votes than their opponents. And joining us now, Jonathan Taplin, founder and director emeritus of the Innovation Lab at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Southern California, where he specializes in international communications management and digital media entertainment. He began his entertainment career as tour manager for Bob Dylan and the band and produced Martin Scorsese's first feature film, Mean Streets. He went on to produce television documentaries, including The Prize and Cadillac Desert for PBS, and 12 feature films, including The Last Waltz, Under Fire, and To Die For. And his latest book is Move Fast and Break Things, How Google, Facebook, and Amazon Cornered Culture and Undermined Democracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jonathan Taplin.
Good to be with you, Ian.
Well, thank you. And this video that's gone viral of Nancy Pelosi appearing to be drunk and slurring her words is pretty mild in the context of the potential harm that this deepfake technology can do. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is a fairly crude one, but the possibility, as you mentioned, Jordan Peele showed, of literally putting words in people's mouths that they never said is almost endless. And the ability to synthesize speech, as we prove with Barack Obama, in other words, we get the exact intonations right, and the ability to move lips in sync with this new speech through artificial intelligence manipulation of the video makes it possible to make a very convincing video of something, and it could go as, on one level, it could go as far as having a deep fake of President Trump saying he just launched a nuclear strike on North Korea, to potentially putting a rival political candidate in a room with a woman who's not his wife. You know, I mean, these things, you know, this technology started out, ironically, in pornography, which young, bored, male AI trolls would take Scarlett Johansson's head and morph it onto the body of some porn star so they had a Scarlett Johansson porn video.
And then they go out and sell that?
Oh, yeah. They sell it on the dark web all the time.
Oh, I see. So if for example, the Russians, Prigozhin, Putin's chef, that ran the troll factory, or still runs it, in St. Petersburg, that was involved in the 2016 election through the GRU, the Russian military intelligence. We know what they did. The audience is pretty familiar with that. But imagine if they made the fake video that you just talked about, the one of Donald Trump declaring a nuclear war on North Korea, and if they play that on Russian television, we could have World War III, right? Armageddon.
Well, they didn't even need to use television. They just put it up on Twitter.
Right.
And within an hour, it's got 10 million viewers.
Right.
You know, I mean, the point is, here's the deal. Facebook and Twitter and YouTube all have the technology in-house to block these videos. Just because they're made by artificial intelligence, it just so happens that artificial intelligence tools can also detect that a video has been manipulated, can detect all the things that you see on the Jordan Peele video, which is, by the way, on YouTube and worth anyone looking at. Just Google Jordan Peele Obama video, and it'll show you exactly how good this technology is. But the AI can actually detect it. So these companies should have upload filters. In other words, it should be blocked before it ever gets out, because it doesn't do any good to say, okay, we'll take it down, you know, 6 hours after it went up, like Facebook did with the Christchurch mass murder video, which was not fake, but just shows you how incompetent they are in dealing with this new phenomena.
Well, but their attitude to taking down the this Nancy Pelosi fake video was extraordinarily arrogant and irresponsible.
I totally agree. I mean, they basically said, well, the viewer should be able to make up their mind what they think is true. But if you can't believe your eyes, and essentially we're going to get to a place where nothing is true. And, you know, some people say we're already there. We're in the era of Trump as the post-truth age. But I'm not positive that that's a healthy thing. And the idea that Facebook would leave it up to the individual viewer to try and find out whether something was manipulated or not is insane, when they have the tools themselves to say this is not real.
And again, I'm speaking with Jonathan Taplin, founder and director emeritus of the Innovation Lab at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Southern California, where he specializes in international communication management and digital media entertainment. He began his entertainment career as tour manager for Bob Dylan and the band, and produced Martin Scorsese's first feature film, Mean Streets, and went on to produce television documentaries, including The Prize and Cadillac Desert for PBS, and 12 feature films, including The Last Waltz, Under Fire, and To Die For. His latest book is Move Fast and Break Things, How Google, Facebook, and Amazon Cornered Culture and Undermined Democracy. Now, apparently, as of Friday, the Nancy Pelosi slurring her words, appearing to be drunk video, has been viewed more than 2.5 million times. So I imagine it's way up there now. And then Trump also tweeted a clip from Fox News that compiled a whole bunch of video of Nancy Pelosi stumbling over her words, and that he tweeted out quite openly. So this is it does feel like an open season on the truth and on facts and on, you know, we are, as you mentioned, in post-truth America, and, you know, motto, if you will, is to try to build a reality-based community in post-truth America. But with these kind of AI tools and deep fake, you're pretty much tilting at windmills, aren't you? This is
well. No, there's a solution to this, and it's fairly simple. These companies, Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, operate under a legal liability regime called Safe Harbor. And essentially what it says, no provider or user of an interactive computer service should be treated as the publisher or speaker of any information provided by another information content provider. In other words, they're taking the stance that they have no responsibility for anything that's on their platform. And because they have this safe harbor so that you cannot sue them or Nancy Pelosi cannot sue them for putting up this fake, they have no reason to take it down. Now, this safe harbor was originally meant for telephone companies. In other words, Verizon doesn't know what's flowing over its wires. It doesn't try and censor the bits. It doesn't do anything. But Facebook and YouTube do all sorts of things. They give you different information than they give me. They filter out porn. They filter out jihadist videos. It's just they get to make the total final and last decision on what they want to filter and what they don't want to filter. And the reason they filter out porn is that their advertisers don't like it. And the reason they started to filter out jihadist beheading videos was for the same reason, when Procter & Gamble found an ad on one of these jihadist beheading videos and raised bloody hell. So, I mean, here's the deal. This could be changed in an instant. These companies, these safe harbor laws were made for what we call passive intermediaries. That's Verizon, AT&T. But Facebook and YouTube are active intermediaries. And they shouldn't have that safe harbor. And if they had the threat of being sued for putting up this stuff, then they would change their content protection policies in an instant, and we wouldn't have this problem.
Well, it is. Are you saying then, Jonathan Taplin, that that Facebook and these other platforms, Google, etc., and Amazon, that they should operate under the same rules that publishers of newspapers and books?
Exactly. Uh-huh. Exactly. So because let's be honest. According to the Pew study, 60% of Americans under the age of 35 believe that they get most of their news from Facebook and YouTube. Now, if that's true, then they are news providers, and as the Prime Minister of New Zealand, Prime Minister Ardern, said, they are the publisher, not the postman. They cannot be a case of all profit and no responsibility. And that's the basic problem. They want all the money, but they don't want any of the responsibility, whether it's putting up fake videos like deep fakes like the Nancy Pelosi thing, or whether it's posting mass murder broadcast live to millions of people.
Well, speech that you just, or that excerpt of her speech, the New Zealand Prime Minister's speech, that was sitting beside Macron, and was it not, in France, where they have offered up an international regime, which the United States immediately rejected.
Exactly. Most of the civilized countries in the world are trying to bring these companies to heel. The U.S. continues to forget that, partially because I think Trump wouldn't have been elected if it hadn't been Facebook, posting a lot of fake news and the kind of memes that depressed black voting and all sorts of other things. So he still thinks, and he's advertising more on Facebook than all the Democratic candidates combined. So he still thinks it's the platform for him to win. And since Facebook has no regulations as to what you advertise, it's not like a broadcast TV where if you put on a political advertisement, it has to be true or the FCC revokes your license. On Facebook, nothing has to be true.
Well, one of the things, just in closing, that I find extraordinary is that Facebook's sort of started out with a pretty benign reputation, and I think people are starting to slowly wake up to some of the problems that they've refused to deal with. And again, it's the sort of attitude, I'm the piano player in the whorehouse, you know. But right. the point is that you can, that there's no way in the world that you can't notice that Zuckerberg is not, you know, I don't know why progressives and liberals think he's okay, because his mentor, for God's sake, is Rupert Murdoch. And they've just hired these outside people to monitor this kind of stuff we're talking about. And many of the people they hired came from the Koch organization. So, you know, he's right. I don't know who's looked into the ties between the Trump campaign and Brad Parcells and Facebook, but they're pretty tight, aren't they?
They're very tight. I mean, you know, Facebook embedded two of its most brilliant advertising specialists in the Trump campaign in 2016. And you know, let's not forget that Peter Thiel was the second major investor into Facebook. And, you know, he, needless to say, is a huge Trump fan. So, I mean, look, Facebook is a net negative to society. There's just no doubt about it. If Facebook went away, nothing in your life would really change. But a lot of good things would happen. A lot of this toxic, untrue, fake content would disappear. And that, to me, would be a net positive to society.
Well, Jonathan Taplin, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Jonathan Taplin, who's founder and director emeritus of the Innovation Lab at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Southern California, where he specializes in international communication management and digital media entertainment. He began his entertainment career as tour manager for Bob Dylan and the band and produced Martin Scorsese's first feature film, Mean Streets. He went on to produce television documentaries, including The Prize and Cadillac Desert for PBS, and 12 feature films, including The Last Waltz, Under Fire, and To Die For. And his latest book is Move Fast and Break Things, How Google, Facebook, and Amazon Cornered Culture and Undermined Democracy. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back joined in the studio by the author of the new book just out, Surprise, Kill, Vanish, The Secret History of CIA Paramilitary Armies, Operators, and Assassins. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now in the studio is Annie Jacobson, who is the author of Area 51, An Uncensored History of America's Top Secret Military Base. She's an investigative journalist and contributing editor at the Los Angeles Times Magazine and the author of the widely read series, The Road to Area 51. And her latest book just out is Surprise, Kill, Vanish, The Secret History of CIA Paramilitary Armies, Operators, and Assassins. Welcome to Background Briefing, Annie Jacobson.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. And I don't think it's hyperbole to suggest that secret operators, proxies, shadow people like Eric Prince and his mercenary army that happened to be situated in the United Arab Emirates, right there in Ground Zero in the Gulf, where there are rumors of war, and the possibility that something could spark a wider conflagration, a shadow warrior. I mean, we know, for example, we're starting to learn now that the so-called tanker sabotage that was ballyhooed recently might well have been a false flag operation. So do you think that the world that you've explored in this new book, Surprise, Kill, Vanish, could be the tail that wags the dog and triggers the next war?
You know, it's a great conundrum, all of it. But one thing I will say, everything I write in Surprise, Kill, Vanish, no matter how shocking it may seem, it's all legal. So to clarify, a guy like Prince is outside of the national security world that I write in as much that I'm writing specifically about the CIA and their paramilitary operations, whereas Prince is a civilian working on contracts. So while the area seems muddy to a lot of individuals, I think it's important to see how that specific line between the two, because everything the CIA is doing is legal under a code called Title 50.
And if you think the CIA is a menace to society, what about JSOC? JSOC has a parallel operation, Shadow Warriors, what, 100 times the budget, 10 times the budget? God knows.
The Pentagon's budget is just astronomical compared to the CIA. And again, it's something I really looked at through the long lens of history to try to show readers how much of this fits together. But the Pentagon operates under what's called Title 10, and that is a very different code. So Title 50 is what allows the CIA to do the most extreme form of paramilitary operations, which is assassination. You know, people sometimes balk and they say, oh, Annie, that's not true. They're not allowed to do that. Well, they are. And I'll give you an example. From the National Archives, I was able to demonstrate all the different presidents, the different assassination programs they have and what they called it. So just to give you an indicator, Eisenhower called his the Health Alteration Committee. JFK called his Executive Action. President Reagan called it Preemptive Neutralization. And Obama called his targeted killing. So you see that evolution across time from sort of euphemism to really hitting the nail on the head and calling it what it is, targeted killing.
So let's go back to Clinton, who got heavily criticized by Mike Scheuer, for example, the guy that ran the bin Laden unit at the CIA, who felt that Clinton had missed opportunities to kill bin Laden. And one of them apparently was, again, we're talking about the United Arab Emirates. The Emirati princes were out falcon hunting somewhere in Afghanistan. And the CIA had a sniper with one of those 50 caliber sniper rifles, had bin Laden in his sights and wanted to kill him, but was told he couldn't do it because they looked at the tail numbers of all the private jets and traced them back to these princes. And Lockheed was about to sell a bunch of F-16s to the Emiratis. So that's what I was told was the reason why they didn't pull the trigger. So walk us through that.
Well, you know, you've brought up a fascinating point. Of all the presidents that have these programs for assassination, targeted killing, call it what you will, the only one who didn't was President Clinton. Therein lies this huge puzzle, and you have to ask yourself that chicken and the egg conundrum, the story you tell being one example. I don't have the specifics on that, but I too have heard a similar version of that. What I do know from firsthand sources is that there were two other times bin Laden was in the CIA's sights. They wanted to kill him. One was in Sudan in the early 90s. I write about that at length through the eyes of my main character, a guy named Billy Waugh. And the other was with that Predator drone before 9/11 that so famously has been told as well. Both times Clinton said no, and I'm paraphrasing the president, of course, but he didn't believe in assassination. Once he sent 62 Tomahawk missiles and missed. So that brings up the bigger question we talked about, because the 62 Tomahawk missiles going at bin Laden in Afghanistan is a Pentagon operation. So there's that 10 times the issue. And my take on that, I try to stay out of opinion and just here are the facts. Mm-hmm. But I couldn't help but have an opinion about that, which is, okay, so America opposes this idea of taking someone out with a sniper rifle or a knife to the neck, as the CIA paramilitary operators do and narrate to me in the book. But we're okay, the president is okay, sending 62 Tomahawk missiles to do untold number of damages and miss the target.
Sure, and because the Pakistanis tipped off bin Laden, since they were flying over Pakistan territory. And I guess the U.S. had to tell them.
Absolutely. So you have like sort of the military-industrial complex up against this shadow world, or really and truly what that is called is the president's hidden hand. That is what the CIA operators do.
And again, Annie Jacobson's joined me in the studio. She's the author of Area 51, An Uncensored History of America's Top Secret Military Bases, which was a finalist for Pulitzer Prize. She's an investigative journalist and contributing editor at the Los Angeles Times Magazine and the author of the widely read series, The Road to Area 51. And her latest book just out is Surprise, Kill, Vanish, The Secret History of CIA Paramilitary Armies, Operators, and Assassins. So you mentioned Billy War, who's kind of a legendary figure who ran the CIA's paramilitary operations for some time. And I was told that the plan to kill bin Laden when he was in Sudan involved killing him and then tossing his body over the wall of the Iranian embassy. Is that what?
Well, that's right. And okay, so to clarify, Billy Waugh didn't run the organization. Right. He was what's called a singleton. That's a single man operator who's out there. His cover was that he was an old man on a jogging fitness craze. He would run around Sudan, run around Khartoum, you know, dressed like with a headband and jogging shorts. Bin Laden's dogs would come after him, and he first took pictures of Bin Laden, identifying him. This is in the early 90s, before Bin Laden was a real threat. And as I tell in the book, there are two versions of the story. Billy Waugh told me his suggestion was, let's kill Bin Laden, throw his body over the Iranian embassy to kind of create this false flag. And then he even suggested throwing some grenades, some flash grenades, to draw attention, to get everyone to run to the embassy to take photographs so that press would be called and there would be attention drawn to it and the killing would be blamed on the Iranians. Now, Waugh's boss, a guy named Kofor Black, in interviews with me for the book, denied that story, said, because Waugh said the request went all the way to President Clinton and it came back saying, please don't ever ask me anything like this again. Kofor Black said he never sent the request to President Clinton, he never would. So readers get to decide whose version of events they think is more credible there.
So whatever happened to the injunction under President Ford against executive assassination?
What a great point you've brought up. And I clarify that in the book. You know, whenever anyone gets assassinated these days by, you know, let's say a drone strike, journalists often repeat this phrase, according to EO 12333, assassination is prohibited. EO stands for executive order. Well, that's not exactly true, because as Congress warned in the Church Committee hearings that you're referring to in 1975, an EO, an executive order, can be overwritten by another president's executive order, which has happened consistently throughout history. And so Congress has never passed a law against assassination. And it is believed by scholars who I interviewed that this is for a very specific reason, so that the idea of, let's call it, preemptive neutralization can continue in the shadows, in secret.
Well, you brought up drones. I mean, that has become the instrument of choice, has it not?
Absolutely. And, you know, here's another real chicken and egg scenario. I mean, President Obama got rid of the enhanced interrogation program, or the torture program, as it's also called. But he accelerated drone strikes. So he, in essence, had more people targeted, you know, killed through targeting or assassinated, than any president before him, setting a precedent, sort of kicking the door open wide for this. Those drone strikes are part of what is called the CIA's air branch. The ground operators like Billy Waugh and other teams I write about in Surprise, Kill, Vanish, they're part of what is called the CIA's ground branch. There's also a maritime branch, which is a jealously guarded secret that covers operations, infiltration and exfiltration through the water.
So, there's a parallel Pentagon drone operation too, right? So, to what's the difference between the CIA's? What are the protocols or restrictions on the CIA's program vis-a-vis the Pentagon's drone program?
So, the CIA can operate anywhere in the world at the behest of the president. The Pentagon operates under Title 10, and that is rules of engagement. So they cannot operate, they cannot kill someone in a sovereign nation, that we are not at war. So for example, when Bin Laden was killed, yes, credit goes to the SEALs, okay? But that was not a SEAL team operation, that was a CIA operation. Those operators, while they were SEAL trained, they were essentially made CIA operators for the night, which is why you saw Leon Panetta, director of the CIA at the time, in that famous photograph beside Bin Laden.
So McRaven was basically dragooned into the CIA for 24 hours.
Yes, absolutely. And so that'll, because Pakistan is a sovereign nation, you can't just go kill someone inside someone else's country, but the CIA can because of its Title 50 authority.
Well, of course, we're talking about the CIA at a point where we're kind of counting on the CIA to make a stand against our own president, who's given the Attorney General a carte blanche to rummage through the most secret files they have in order to cherry-pick information to help Trump's case that he's trying to build to investigate the investigators who investigated him in the Mueller report. So I know that's not how, what your book deals with.
Well, it does in theory, let's say, because I think what I try to present, I always try to write books that are not polemics. I don't want to have an opinion per se. I try to say, here are the facts, you guys decide. And what I did find in all of this is that, with the exception of President Clinton, every president, whether they're Republican or Democrat, has had this program, has used this capacity, this paramilitary capacity, often because what they are trying to do, readers get to decide for better or for worse, to prevent war, to prevent open war. That's why they call the CIA paramilitary wing tertia optio, third option. So the president, we all know, has diplomacy is always the first option. War is the second option. And when diplomacy fails and war is an unwise idea, the president calls upon the CIA. So to your question about this you know, what's happening between the Justice Department and the CIA and the president, I saw in my review of history, in my review of documents supporting this, and my interviews with firsthand operators, a neutrality about all of this, that what the operators were doing was at the president's behest. So it is very interesting at this point in time to ask oneself, is the CIA following the president's behest, or are they following their mandate at the CIA? And I think time will reveal more.
Well, I've always thought it was a real paradox that mostly on the left, there's been this idea that the CIA is the root of all evil and behind all the terrible things that have happened in the world, and more often than not, maybe these arguments are correct with blowback, etc. But the point is that even Jack Kennedy, after the Bay of Pigs, who said, I'm going to smash the CIA to 1,000 pieces, ended up using it with a vengeance against trying to assassinate Fidel Castro. And there's a museum in Havana with all of the tools that were given to this guy, Colonel Cabela, who turned out to be what they call a dangle, who was recruited by Desmond Fitzgerald, who was the CIA station chief in Paris. That is, you know, an example of why is it in history that we don't blame the presidents? Because, you know, as you've made it clear, the CIA has become their favorite toy. Jimmy Carter was another one. He got elected during the Church Committee thing as a way to sort of rein in the CIA. And, you know, he used them, obviously, to effectively suck, you know, attract the Russians into, or the Soviets into Afghanistan. So can you address that? I know it's specifically not in your book, but it's something that I've always found a little paradoxical.
Well, it actually is in the book, and it's a wonderful point you brought up, because you know, the president uses the CIA to his advantage and knows that its actions will remain hidden unless there is a gross failure. And that's what happened to Kennedy. And one of the things that I was really surprised to learn in researching this book in the archives and at JFK's library, looking at his archives, was that he was so humiliated by what happened at the Bay of Pigs in his first 100 days of his presidency, that he actually upended this order, which we see the blowback to today, okay? So what Kennedy did, he was so furious with the CIA, he reversed the authorities. He gave the Pentagon, the Defense Department, that Title 50 authority. And there began the covert missions in Vietnam. So that he had the Pentagon acting like a paramilitary capacity. He had the Pentagon doing what the CIA normally does. And the Pentagon, with all its money and power, was suddenly able to take these operations to a factor that the CIA had never, ever been able to do with its small footprint. And it really conflagrated the situation in Vietnam. And arguably, I think if you read Surprise, Kill, Vanish, you have trouble seeing anything other than, my God, Kennedy lit a fire in Vietnam out of his own furor that the CIA had embarrassed him.
Well, but you could go back to his predecessor, Dwight David Eisenhower. Eisenhower had a very successful visit with Khrushchev here in Los Angeles. He wanted to go to Disneyland, but they didn't let him. But he got to meet Shirley MacLaine on the set of a movie at Fox and all that. So he had a great time. They really bonded. And so Khrushchev goes back to the Soviet Union and builds a golf course down in Georgia on the Black Sea for Eisenhower, and they're getting ready for a summit to literally end the Cold War. And what happens on May Day, which is the holy day in the Soviet Union, a CIA spy plane, a U-2 plane with Francis Gary Powers in the cockpit, is shot down. The CIA assure Eisenhower that the pilot is dead. So they put out the cover story that it was a weather plane that went astray. And, of course, Khrushchev didn't know what to do because he wanted the summit to go ahead. But he was getting pressure from his military and his military-industrial complex. And it's one of the great tragedies of history that, the Cold War could possibly have ended back in 1960. But it was, in effect, prolonged and ramped up because of, again, a president the CIA getting out ahead of a president. And Eisenhower really, every time he had to sign off on those U-2 flights, he always had deep trepidation.
You know, I love that story because it reminds us that what's happening today, there's an analogy in all of that, how presidents are constantly in this position of having to try and please their foreign adversaries and at the same time follow the suggestions of the CIA and the Pentagon.
Well, Annie, I'm very grateful for you joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to take a brief station break and back discussing how Nevada just became the 15th state to adopt the National Popular Vote Bill, which works around the Electoral College by having states grant its electoral votes to whoever wins the popular vote nationwide. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Sanford Levinson, who holds a W. St. John Garwood Centennial Chair in Law at the University of Texas Law School. He's a regular contributor to the popular blog Balkanization, and he's written 6 books, including Wrestling with Diversity, Our Undemocratic Constitution, Where the Constitution Goes Wrong, and How We the People Can Correct It. And with his wife, Cynthia Levinson, he wrote Fault Lines in the Constitution, The Framers, Their Fights, and the Flaws That Affect Us Today. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sanford Levinson.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, thank you. And the man who helped invent the scratch-off lottery ticket, John Kozer, sometime back co-founded the National Popular Vote Initiative, or Compact, and a number of states have picked it up, including just recently Nevada. They passed a bill that basically grants its electoral votes to whoever wins the popular vote, which is a pretty simple fix.
Right.
But you don't think it's enough of a fix to, in terms of how to get rid of the Electoral College, which, needless to say, most voters in this country support abolishing the Electoral College.
Right. Yeah, I think it is a good solution to what happened in 2016, where the winner came in second in the national popular vote, and a lot of people were justifiably upset. But I think we should also have our attention on at least two earlier races, that is 1968 and 1992, where Richard Nixon and Bill Clinton respectively got to the White House with only 43% of the vote. They came in first, but they still had been rejected initially by 57% of the voters. And I think that is at least as serious a problem as the problem revealed by 2016. So I give the Fair Vote Project a resounding two cheers, because I think that they're really raising important questions, and they're doing vital work. On the other hand, I'm not willing to give it a full three cheers, because I think that we're not that much better off if the person who comes in first gets the White House, but that person gets, as I say, only, say, 43, 42% of the vote, that I think it's very, very important that the president be able to demonstrate the support of a majority of the country, and we don't have that system right now.
But isn't the two examples you gave, Clinton and Nixon, Clinton didn't get to the majority because of Ross Perot splitting the vote, and Nixon because of George Wallace. Isn't that a separate issue, the fact that we have a winner-take-all system, and more often than not, when you have a third-party candidate running, like, for example, Ralph Nader in Florida 2000,
right,
most people think he handed the victory to George W. Bush because 97,000 votes went for Nader in Florida, and Gore lost by 537 votes. And then you more recently, of course, in the last election, Jill Stein got more votes in those
right.
three key swing states than Hillary Clinton lost by.
Right. The real problem, though, is that we'll never really and truly know how the votes would have been allocated, especially with somebody like Perot. And this, the way we do things also really discourages the rise of a serious third or fourth party. One of the things that makes the United States exceptional, and I don't think this is something we should be that proud of, is that we really are pretty much locked within a two-party system. Most other countries around the world, especially if you look at those countries that, you know, are large-sized, operate under a multi-party system. And if we had a system like in France or the state of Georgia in the United States, or in many other places where there are runoffs, or my own favorite would be an alternative transfer rule vote of the kind that you see now in Maine, or I think in San Francisco, you could have a genuine third-party candidacy that wouldn't merely be a spoiler, that the winner would be the person who came in overall first and could make a plausible claim to have the support of the majority, which Richard Nixon could make only if you assume that he would have gotten most of the Wallace votes, which may be true, but we really can't be certain. With Perot, it's even more complicated. And I think that we unnecessarily harm our politics by discouraging third parties and not getting the benefit that one can get from dissident parties, because under our system, what third or fourth parties usually do is screw things up. And you look around the world and there are solutions to this problem.
Well, of course, Australia have what they call preferential voting, which is what you're referring
right,
to.
Right,
and,
right.
They also have compulsory voting as well, which
right,
means you
right.
have, always have a big turnout. Again, I'm speaking with Sanford Levinson, who holds the W. St. John Garwood Centennial Chair in Law at the University of Texas Law School, a regular contributor to the popular blog Balkanization. He has written 6 books, including Wrestling with Diversity, Our Undemocratic Constitution, Where the Constitution Goes Wrong, and How We the People Can Correct It. And with his wife, Cynthia Levinson, he wrote Fault Lines in the Constitution, The Framers, Their Fights, and the Flaws That Affect Us Today. So going back to the framers and their fights, that's why we have an electoral college, right? The smaller states simply weren't going to give in on having the 2 senators.
Well, certainly that. I mean, the Senate is what the real fight was about. The Electoral College is almost an afterthought because there was a huge amount of debate on how to elect a president, and the Electoral College was chosen only toward the very end, frankly, when people were extremely eager to get out of Philadelphia. There were some proposals to have the president chosen by Congress, and that was rejected because it seemed just to give too much power to Congress. There were a few people who supported a national popular vote, but in 1787, it actually made sense to be suspicious of the national popular vote, because there were no national parties, there were no national media, and therefore it really was extraordinarily difficult to envision that ordinary people, even if we're talking only about ordinary white males, who would be the only people allowed to vote, in Massachusetts, New Hampshire, North Carolina, whatever, would actually be aware of who might be sitting candidates for the presidency. So the idea of electors made sense. The idea was that people living in Massachusetts or people living in North Carolina could at least look around them and pick the local notables who might in fact be aware of who could supply good national leadership. And so that meant that we really didn't need a party system and we could survive not having national media. Now, obviously, in the 21st century, we don't live in that world. We have national political parties. We have national media. Electors have become meaningless in terms of actually engaging genuine choice. So the original intent of the Electoral College basically collapsed in the early 19th century when electors became merely the delegates of the voters rather than trustees who would exercise independent judgment. There's a third factor that's very, very important, and that unfortunately continues to be true today, that slave states liked the Electoral College because the Electoral College makes the power of the state independent of the actual number of voters who turn out. So the so-called Three-Fifths Compromise that gave slave states extra representatives in the House, that ended up, and this is more important than the Senate, in fact, because the Three-Fifths Compromise ended up giving slave states undeserved representation in the House. And that meant, for example, that Thomas Jefferson, who only narrowly got to the White House in 1800, did so basically because he benefited from the slavery bonus in Virginia and other of the slave states. And that continues to be true even today, in that it is well known that there are a number of states where the people in control are really trying to suppress the vote of their political opponents. Republicans have been particularly notorious for doing this in recent years in cases like Texas, states like Texas, Wisconsin, Michigan, and elsewhere. And they have every incentive to do so, because all they want to do is to get out the vote of their own base. And it's fine to suppress the vote of their political opponents. They will get the same number of electoral votes regardless of what the popular vote is. Whereas if we elected candidates by popular vote, then, frankly, it wouldn't matter that much if Republicans in Wisconsin could suppress, say, 30,000 votes in Milwaukee, because in a national electorate of 120 million people, the 30,000 people would be statistically insignificant. And we are extraordinarily unlikely to have election so close that 30,000 votes would really tip it at the national level. But given the Electoral College, it can be extraordinarily important, as it was in 2000 and as it was in 2016, if you have even a few hundred votes or a few thousand votes of your opponents suppressed or otherwise not counted, because you get the whole state. I mean, George W. Bush did not get a majority of the vote in Florida. He simply was announced as coming in first by about 550 votes, and he got all of Florida's electoral votes, because with the exception of Maine and Nebraska, all of the states think they can maximize their own clout by having a winner-take-all system. So you have all of these various perverse incentives in the Electoral College. You know, everybody is now familiar with the fact that the Electoral College reduces campaigning to a relatively few battleground states. I mean, people in California almost never know there's a presidential election going on, because at least for the last several cycles, and I think undoubtedly for the upcoming cycle, it's just a given that the Democrat will carry California, so you're not going to see the candidates. They're going to target the so-called battleground states, and that means they're not only going to pay many, many visits and have a lot of advertising, but they'll pander to the particular interests of the battleground states and really ignore the interests of the largest states where most people in the United States live, but that are relatively predictable in the way they're going to vote. Texas has four of the 11 largest cities in the United States, and now for a number of cycles, we wouldn't know in Texas that there's a presidential campaign going on. And candidates rarely really speak to the problem of America's largest cities. So the whole system has perverse consequences.
Well, just in closing, it's been predicted that by the year 2040 or 2050 or sometime in between, there will be 70 Republican senators in the U.S. Senate and only 30 Democratic senators because of the Electoral College and because of a demographic shift away from depopulating the red states and concentrating people into blue states where their votes are diluted, as we saw with Hillary Clinton's
right,
winning 3 million more votes than Donald Trump, but they didn't
right,
count because they're mostly in California and New York, etc.
Right.
That is the trend. And of course, if you control the Senate, you control the courts. So right. we'll end up in an increasingly undemocratic America, dominated by the Republicans, who and the Democrats will only be able to win the House and the presidency. So that is not a good omen.
So I couldn't agree with you more. But what I would say, as awful as the Electoral College is, the U.S. Senate is far worse. And what you're describing is altogether accurate. I mean, even today, a majority of the population live in 9 states who get 18 senators, and the rest of the population get 82 senators. And what you're describing is, you know, the further playing out of that grotesque disproportion. But frankly, even if we waved a magic wand and got a national popular vote tomorrow and eliminated the Electoral College, that wouldn't come close to curing the problem of the Senate, which is by far the most vivid and outrageous and important example of the disproportionate power held by a basically rural, increasingly white part of the American population as against these states where most Americans live.
Well, Sanford Levinson, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Sanford Levinson, who holds the W. St. John Garwood Centennial Chair in Law at the University of Texas Law School, a regular contributor to the popular blog Balkanization. He's written 6 books about wrestling, 6 books including Wrestling with Diversity, Our Undemocratic Constitution, Where the Constitution Goes Wrong, and How We the People Can Correct It. And with his wife, Cynthia Levinson, he wrote Fault Lines in the Constitution, The Framers, Their Fights, and the Flaws That Affect Us Today. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.